Welcome to the latest edition of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
Today we're going to be talking about what seems like a really simple idea. Should we buy something that's wild-caught, or should we buy something that's tank-raised, captive-bred, captive-raised, whatever term you want to use? They all do kind of mean different things, but let's just say something wild-caught versus something that was bred or raised in captivity.
It seems so simple on the surface, and this is one that I've been sort of looking forward to talking to and talking about and dreading talking about for different reasons. like I think people are going to expect us to believe differently than we do.
Tank raised all the time. Tank raised all the time.
But I think that people would also expect us to be avoiding the subject, and I find that to be the opposite of the case. I feel like I always want to talk to people about this, and people don't want to hear it as much.
I got into a debate with a customer like a week ago on it.
Yeah.
It's perfect. So why is there a debate? When we go through this topic, we're going to talk about corals, we're going to talk about fish, and we're going to talk about plants. We're going to use terms like in situ mariculture, aquaculture. We're going to talk about biopiracy. We're going to talk about fishing methods, sustainability, all of that stuff.
All those big triggering topics.
Yeah, and hopefully, we piss some people off into taking action.
Oh, it's not hopeful. It's definitely going to happen in this conversation.
Yeah. I'm already a little pissed off, so maybe let's start off defining some terms then.
Sure.
What do we mean when we say captive bred, wild caught, tank raised, aquacultured, maricultured? What do those terms mean to us?
So let's start. Should we talk about corals first or fish first? Or plants first?
I think maybe we need to define those words, because I think once we get started, we're going to talk about whatever comes to our heads. We can't stop ourselves.
Okay, so some big terms would be aquacultured versus in situ maricultured. That's usually terms used in reference to corals. So it seems like the obvious choice. Corals are the corals of the world are being destroyed, so we shouldn't take stuff off of them. So the answer would be to aquaculture all of our corals. Aquaculture we would refer to as growing a coral in a non-native environment. So coral greenhouses would be aquacultured corals.
Or you fragging your corals in your 40-gallon reef tank.
Yeah.
That's still aquaculture.
Yeah. In situ mariculture would be coral farms that happen in their native habitats.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares?
Yeah.
By the way, I do.
Yeah,
very
I care a lot. Yeah. On the coral front, those terms are very important. And on the fish front, we're looking at wild caught fish that are brought in from the wild. That's pretty simple. Captive bred, fish that are born and raised in captivity, and captive raised, which are fish that are often caught in the wild and raised in captivity.
Larval reared is often the term.
Yeah, that's a better word for it to me, just because it's less confusing.
And it's precise.
It is precise.
Yeah.
Precision is good.
Larval reared would still technically qualify as wild caught.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fish was caught in the wild and raised in captivity, but it was caught often during its larval stage. Why would that be more sustainable?
Well, that's important in saltwater and in freshwater. Honestly, juvenile fish, right? What are the success rates of juvenile fish in the wild? How many of those do genuinely survive to their full lifespan?
Okay, so here's one of my favorite statistics, and we're going to do the math here. So
he's gesturing wildly at Charles so that he can write things down. Because
I can't
do math.
I actually think we did the math on a previous episode, so let me see if I can find that in my notes.
We're going to use the clownfish example because Charles is flipping through his notes to come up with that example. So you're right. We did do it before. So even if we're close, that's fine. Right?
Yeah.
So a pair of clownfish should live for about 25 years. A mature pair of clownfish will most likely reproduce every 2 weeks, producing 300 to 500 eggs. Right? So the simple math there for 1 year, we're gonna go big on this one. We're gonna go 500 eggs, right? So that's 6,000 eggs a year for 25 years.
Our oceans now have nothing but clownfish in them.
Yeah. Right. And oh, by the way, that number for clownfish, that number of eggs produced over the lifespan, that's not an abnormal number of eggs for reef fish. Other fish produce those kinds of numbers over their lifespan. So 6,000 times 25.
It's like a quarter of a million.
Something like that. It's a boatload. We're going to go with a boatload. Okay? So clownfish over their lifespan are going to produce 250,000 babies.
Genghis Khan didn't produce that many babies.
Technically, Genghis Khan didn't. His brother did.
So 250,000 babies in a balanced ecosystem, no single organism's population is neither decreasing nor increasing in numbers, which means in a balanced ecosystem, if there are 12 pairs of clownfish in that particular ecosystem, if it is balanced, 10 years later, there are still 12 pairs. Actually, we're going to go 25 years, right? Because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Balanced ecosystem, 25 years. By the way, there's very little such thing as a balanced ecosystem on coral reefs anywhere in the world right now, but that's a different topic. So let's just say balanced ecosystem, 25 years, which means that pair of clownfish over the course of that 25 years need only replace itself. Which means in a balanced ecosystem, a clownfish egg has a 1 in 125,000 chance of reaching maturity.
Yeah, that kind of puts it all into perspective.
Right.
Sorry, I'm doing the math real quick.
The actual math.
The actual math. So it's 13,000 eggs a year.
13,000 a year.
Yep.
Times 25.
325,000 eggs.
And of that, they theoretically need two.
Two.
Can we even, like, is that even a percentage? Like, at that point, it's like zero, right?
It's, I just did the math, 0.00061% survival rate.
Those are lottery numbers, right?
Yeah.
So the chance of a clownfish growing up, it's lottery money. It's
every clownfish on a reef is a miracle.
Right.
The point of that whole discussion, and clownfish, they're the example we're using because they're the numbers we know off the top of our head.
Right.
But most of those are captive bred anyway. But the point is that if we're taking larval fish, the impact on adult populations is going to be pretty negligible.
It's going to be way less.
Yeah.
Right. So... Dory. Oh, I said her name out loud. Am I allowed to do that?
Legally you are, but maybe we should not.
Okay.
No, I think we can say that.
Blue Regal Tang, Blue Hippo Tang, Royal Regal Tang, Royal Tang, Blue Tang, whatever name you want to call, Para Acantharis Hippotus. Those fish, so I met a guy 20 years ago who was from the Solomon Islands. And the Solomon Islands is an autonomous region that still has minor kingdoms. Each island of the Solomon Islands is controlled by the king of that island, and each one gets to make its own rules on what's allowed to happen there. Obviously, in the Solomon Islands, that's a place where aquarium fish collecting happens. It is also a place where it is not a rich country. There's not a whole lot of income there. So most of the income for many of the places in the Solomon Islands comes from some type of fishing. So one of the regional governors decided, aquarium fish can no longer be collected because they're destroying our reefs. They were selling lots and lots of 2 to 4 inch blue hippo tangs from that region. Suddenly they couldn't do that anymore. So all of those people that were making a living selling blue hippo tanks, by the way, they were probably making 50 cents or a dollar at most per fish.
Right.
Maybe even 25 cents or a nickel per fish. But there, it was enough to at least feed the family. That's right. Just, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was. But
right.
That's what they were making.
It was a source of a living for them.
It was a source of a living for them. So all of a sudden, no, you can't do that. You can go get food fish, but you can't sell to the aquarium ornamental trade anymore. One would think that blue tank populations would increase. Well, those people that used to go out and catch blue tanks to sell the aquarium hobby needed something to eat. Turns out a 14-inch blue tang is pretty tasty. So instead of catching the juveniles that they could sell to the aquarium industry, they were catching the adults. The adults are the breeders. Those are the ones that made it. Those are the ones that won the lottery.
Yeah.
They made it through that process. By the way, tangs produce, they're a scatterer, they're a broadcast spawner. They're producing like 1,000 eggs every couple of weeks and just broadcasting those out into the world. So the numbers are actually lower.
Yeah. And how old would you say that 14-inch blue tang is, ballpark, even?
It should be a 2 or 3 year old fish.
Yeah.
I don't think much older than that.
But living 2 or 3 years when you are growing from a centimeter long to 14-inch long, is that's the most crucial part of their lifespan. You
it
know?
Is. Once you've made it to that 14-inch range, you should be good for a while.
There's not much they can eat you at that point, other than humans.
Right. So the population of blue tangs in that particular region actually went down. They changed that and they went back to saying, oh, turns out we should probably not, we should probably have that source of income. I have another example. In 1997, there was a lady, she's referred to as the Seahorse Lady. She went to the Philippines to do a study on seahorse populations in the Philippines. And one of the big threats to seahorse populations is the Chinese medicinal industry. And many of the seahorses that make it into the Chinese medicinal industry, by the way, that's ground seahorse as a medicine, in case you're wondering exactly what we're talking about there, were coming from the Philippines. So she decided to work with one particular region where there was a village chief that was in charge of how fishing happens in this particular area. It was a PBS special in 1997. You can get the full narration if you Google Seahorse Lady Philippines PBS.
By the way, I'm just going to break in and say, anyone who is called the blank lady is my personal hero. I'm just saying. It doesn't really matter what it is. It's like the bird lady, the seahorse lady, you know.
She would be.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
she would be.
I love her already.
Right. So somehow this lady convinced the regional governor to set up a seahorse sanctuary and say, first, we're not going to sell to the Chinese medicinal industry, which, by the way, the only thing I'm going to say about that, if you can picture a 55-gallon barrel full of dead seahorses.
Ugh.
So let's move past that and talk about the marine ornamental industry.
Yeah.
And she said, instead, we're going to sell only to the marine ornamental industry. That's the only place we're going to sell seahorses to. Which, by the way, wild-caught seahorses are not a good thing in the industry right now. But it made sense for this region at that time, and there are other things that happened as a result of this particular thing that she did. So essentially what she did is she convinced the regional governor to set up a seahorse sanctuary, and then outside of that sanctuary set up what seahorses the people were allowed to harvest. And it was, don't take the big ones, just take the little ones, for lack of a better way to describe it. So don't take any from here. Only take them from here and don't tank the big ones. The seahorse population and the income of the entire village all went up. Because it was sustainably harvested.
Yeah. If you sell them all, what do you have left?
Nothing. And they don't replace.
That's the part of this discussion that's so emotional for me. Like, the regions of the world that we get our fish from are some of the most impoverished places you can imagine. Right. The Amazon River Basin, the Congo River Basin, those Pacific Islands. Those are places where people are scraping by.
Scraping by and very, very dependent on the water.
Yeah.
For their...
That's income. Their entire lifestyle is right. built around the water because that's what's all around them. So... If we can find sustainable ways to give them income and improve their lives, I mean, that seems like a no-brainer to me.
I got two examples related to this part of the discussion. I'm particularly of the opinion that there are some circumstances you can argue it, but I think any average person should be buying wild-caught cardinal tetras.
Yes.
Right.
Particularly because of the efforts of Project
Paibas.
Thank you.
Yes, I always say it wrong.
I am not a Spanish speaker, so I appreciate Ben having my back there.
Portuguese.
Well, I guess it's Brazil right there. Yeah. The Rio Negro.
I speak English and German, so.
So you have probably the worst accent for that.
I'm not even going to try.
Yeah, I can't stop my Midwest from coming through ever, so I won't even try.
So.
Piab. Oh.
But a big deal about that is a lot of these regions where this is happening, they're not logging anymore because they make more money catching cardinal tetras, which are an annual fish.
Go back and explain the project, because I think a lot of our listeners probably won't even know that it exists.
So if I remember correctly, it started like they got their first, its origins were in the late 80s. And it was basically one of the universities in the area. They were doing research on like sustainability of fish harvesting. And then like in the mid 90s is when it became a nonprofit and it started actually going out and educating people in these areas. Like, so if you fish this way and in these ways, and then if you cycle through these areas, you can do this sustainably and just keep having a consistent source of income doing that. And it's had tremendous success in the regions they've had their umbrella touch into. I don't know what the phrase I'm looking for here is, but it's just really fascinating to me because it's a way that I get to have what I want and the rainforest doesn't get cut down and people get to still make a living.
Yeah,
honestly, they would make a better living catching these fish for people like us than they would cutting down the rainforest.
We would not have cardinal tetras if those forests were gone.
Right.
And so the support of the program that has focused on training these fishermen in the Amazon to sustainably harvest the fish so that we can have them actually serves to protect the region that we care about the most to protect. So if more of our fisheries could operate that way, then aquarium collecting could be sustainable in the wild at large scale. Like cardinal tetras, a lot of those move through, and that's a pretty sustainable operation.
So for people not familiar with cardinal tetra biology, the reason Charles referred to them as an annual fish, the reason all of us think of them as just tetras that could live in our tanks for about 5 or 6 years, is because they live in regions of the rainforest that experience wet seasons and dry seasons, the flooded regions of the Amazon. One of the studies done on cardinal tetras, actually it was a similar study done on mosquitoes. They compared the two. Right now, if every single mosquito, adult mosquito in the entire planet would die.
Right. We all could breathe well over the summer.
For about 24 hours. It would not have an effect on the overall population of mosquitoes in the world. Cardinal tetras are the same way. They are so prolific. They are so seasonal. If every single adult cardinal tetra right now, poof, gone out of the Amazon River system, it would not affect the overall population of a wild cardinal tetras.
I believe Otocinclus fall in the same category as well.
Oh, I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
lots of these creatures are that way. We have to know which ones.
Yeah.
The reverse of that happened with the infamous L46 Placostomus.
Mm. Yeah.
That's the royal zebra Placostomus. They are found in one very, very small specific region of the Amazon River system. Somebody decided to put some dams up there. They live in fast-moving riffles. They don't survive in slow-moving riffles. The aquarium hobby, contrary to what you may have heard, is not responsible for the destruction of that species in the wild. That was purely the building of those dams. They probably wiped out the entire population of wild zebra placos with those dams. Four dams.
As far as we know.
Right.
But so, as long as we're going down that road, let's tell the story of an example of the aquarium hobby being responsible.
Dennis and Barb's?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah.
I know we've touched on it before. Amy is the one that brought it up in our top five fish that shouldn't be in the hobby video podcast.
We did both.
Yeah. Demand for them just skyrocketed, and there wasn't a infrastructure for sustainability there, and they basically got fished out. And a lot of their availability still exists because I actually looked into this after the episode. Their availability of wild caught ones exists because they're putting more effort into finding the individual ones that are still there because it's still profitable to do so.
Well, they're not cheap fish.
Right.
Actually, right now, pea puffers are pretty much going the same way.
Right.
Because they've exploded in popularity in the last couple of years. And I think this is probably a good distinction for us to make in this conversation, where wild-caught fish, the more popular they are, the more unsustainable it is to get them wild-caught. Generally speaking, cardinal tetras, otocinclus, those are a great example to the contrary. But things like denison barbs and pea puffers...
Yeah, I'm going to argue with you on that one. I think it's too broad a statement.
It is too broad of a statement, but it's more of, like... If something is really popular, it's more important to know where it comes from, I think.
That I will not.
Yeah. That's my main point. Yeah. But I would say that things that are like spiking and hillstream loaches are another good example of, you see wild caught ones sometimes, you see captive bred ones occasionally, but like that just like really bumped up in popularity in the last couple of years. Everybody wants them. So to me, those are the ones that I'm like, that sends my like red flag up, like I need to know what's going on with that fish.
My red flag went up, and the reason I wanted to argue with you about it is because of yellow tangs.
Yeah, so that's a good example.
Yellow tangs in Hawaii, the yellow tangs are endemic to Hawaii, which means that's the only place that they're found. It has been called the most sustainable marine ornamental aquarium collection place on the planet. 70% of the territory where yellow tangs are found, you are not allowed to collect yellow tangs. Okay? Just let that sink in for a minute. 70%.
Yeah.
That means only 30% of the range is open to aquarium collection. I visited some of the places that are open to aquarium collection, and there were yellow tangs everywhere.
Yeah. Imagine what they look like where the yellow tangs are not allowed to be collected.
I visited both, and it's
pretty much the same.
It's incredible. It's incredible. It's a sustainable collection place that some, I want to say well-intended people, but I don't think I can use that term. I think they have a political agenda. They're trying to shut down the collection of yellow tangs in Hawaii. They're trying to shut down the entire marine ornamental fishery in Hawaii. And they're throwing up, puking inaccurate data, misinformation, and fake news about how horrible the yellow tang, how the aquarium collection is destroying, I think... Raping and pillaging the Hawaiian reefs is a quote from
probably.
The brochure. Which,
no,
by the way,
it's definitely a quote. I've seen it.
Okay. Have you seen the inside of that brochure where they actually show a picture of a discus?
I'm nodding my head. I don't know. I haven't gotten used to this audio format. Yeah.
Right. It is absurd propaganda misinformation.
I it's just an easy target. I mean, right now, and it's a good trend. Like, everybody is going more towards being more conscious of how we're treating our planet. And I understand that the aquarium industry should be under, like, it should be under a magnifying glass.
We should be paying attention, close
but
attention.
Just to say simply that a fish in the wild, or a fish out of the wild is a fish that is out of the wild. Like, that's not necessarily the only thing that is a factor in that conversation.
We have to use that big fake news word that everybody is so...
yeah, I hate to, but...
science. The science. People don't care about the science.
Yeah.
This is one that gets me pretty riled up because... Sorry, it's so hard for me to articulate it without getting...
Let it out there, man. Say a bad word if you got to.
I'm just going to have to go for it.
Yeah.
It makes me mad because yellow tangs are these fish that are the poster child of that, but they're sustainably harvested. That's quantifiable. But Achilles tangs are a food fish, and they're disappearing, and that's still allowed. No one cares. No one's talking about it. And I'm like...
Also in Hawaii, black coral collection for jewelry is still happening. That is inherently unsustainable. So what, we're going to call out yellow tangs over that? Like, those corals could be gone soon. And we're caring about yellow tangs, which are not even threatened. Ooh. We're getting mad now.
And I was in a fish market in Hilo buying ahi, which, by the way, ahi is one of the most sustainable food fish. And they had a 5-gallon bucket full of ice and Achilles tangs. Mm. For sale, for people to eat.
Yeah.
5-gallon bucket full.
Yeah. Right?
The retail value of those fish in the aquarium market.
I mean, that was a like $10,000 bucket.
Achilles tangs. And there's not that much meat on an Achilles tang.
No. Like, even a fat one.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
What do we do about that? What do we do about the science that's missing there?
Just education. Like, I think that it's so easy to vilify the aquarium hobby. It's so visible. It's so easy to see.
Right. And to be fair, we need to accept responsibility for the fact that the hobby has not always held itself accountable.
No.
No. The most common method of collecting marine aquarium fish up until the mid-90s and very popular in the 80s was cyanide collection.
Yeah.
Second to that was blast fishing. So in case you're curious about what that means. So the aquarium collectors would go around the reef with a squirt bottle filled with cyanide. And when they'd get to a place where they'd see fish dart into rocks to hide, they'd squirt cyanide into the rock crevice to stun the fish so they could collect it. Some of the statistics out there were it had about a 70 to 80% mortality rate in the fish and about a 30 to 40% mortality rate in the collector.
Wow.
Yes.
It's honestly just completely disgusting.
It still happens today. There are still cyanide collection happening in the Indo-Pacific today. It is dramatically reduced, but it is not eliminated.
Yeah.
It is terrible. Any wholesaler, distributor that supports it or
enables
even turns away and turns it back and just says, we don't know.
Well, that's the horrible thing about cyanide is that they can. Because if a fish is damaged by cyanide, it doesn't always die right away. Sometimes it takes days, sometimes it takes weeks, and by that time it already may be in your tank.
What cyanide does to a fish that's collected is it destroys its ability to digest food. So it will eat, it will poop, it will look at you like it's hungry, and it will slowly waste away.
It's one of the more tragic ways for a fish to die, and we've had a couple of fish in that we suspected were cyanide caught, and they just wasted away, and we had no idea what to do with them.
We as aquarists are responsible for that death. Let me say that again. We as aquarists are responsible for that death.
Yeah.
And I know I get really riled up about it, but I do think a lot of the political backlash the hobby is experiencing is a direct consequence of the fact that we just let that happen for as long as we did.
Fiji did some crazy shutting down about 2-3 years ago. Indonesia followed. And they shut down. All right, so I'm going to shift it to corals here for a little bit. Don't worry, we can come back to where we need to come back to.
No, that's
shift
good.
To corals for a little bit. So we briefly mentioned in situ mariculture versus aquaculture and coral farming. We talked about that a little bit. Fiji was the model of sustainability for the coral collection and farming and mariculture. If you wanted great sustainable corals, they came from Fiji.
Mm-hmm.
They shut it down for all kinds of crazy political reasons, and they put us back probably 20 years, if not longer, with the shutting down they did, because they shut it down for so long that even if they open it back up, those people found other ways of making a living, hopefully.
Yeah.
So to re...
Probably at resorts, like feeding tourists drinks.
Right. To reinstate that infrastructure, it's going to take a long time to get us back to where we were.
Yeah.
All right, so back to why shouldn't it just be that we just aquaculture corals? Like, hey, we get this beautiful, funky... I'm going to make up a coral name here so that I'm not picking at anyone in particular.
Sure.
And we're going to call it the... Because I'm looking at a picture of a yellow fish. The Yellow Phoenix Angel Acro.
Yeah.
I don't think that name is out there, right? But somebody...
But you could just as easily make it up because you have a pretty yellow acro and you want it to sell better.
Yeah. The Yellow Phoenix Angel. Right? I'm writing that down because that's my name,
by
the way.
Let's make it. Yeah. TM, trademark.
Yep.
Copyright. You're going to get sued if you use
Phoenix
it now.
Angel.
Oh, God.
Okay. Because we might have to come back to that example.
Yeah.
Right? So let's just say I went out. Here's how named corals happened. Those organizations that have these funky, beautiful, and I'm not going to pick on anybody in particular, but the funky named corals, what they did is they ordered colonies from various transshippers where they would say, here's box of assorted acro, box of assorted zoanthid, box of assorted Favia, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they went through those corals with magnifying glasses and microscopes to find funky differences, and then took that ones with the funky differences and they aquacultured them. They made more of them, right? And then they gave it the name Yellow Phoenix Angel Acro. Then they sold that 1-inch acro for $150 a frag.
Ooh, cheap. I had to get one of those.
Yeah. Right. Chances are very, very good that anyone who's ever ordered an assorted acro, some of the mariculture acros, probably has Yellow Phoenix Angel Acro. It probably has showed up that way.
Sure.
Right? So what's wrong with that? That guy bought that coral. That guy spent a whole lot of time and really quite a bit of money going through a bunch of, here's a green acro, here's a okay yellow acro, here's an okay red acro. Then he managed to find this incredible yellow one. He put just the right light on it. He put just the right reactors on it, made the calcium perfect, did what he could to make sure that coral was absolutely beautiful. And when you look at some of those named corals, they're incredible.
Oh,
they're,
yeah.
Wow.
The colors are ridiculous.
By the way, if you dive on the reef, they don't all look like that.
Yeah.
These incredibly amazing SPS tanks that have yellow and blue and pink and bold, bright, amazing color. They don't look, that's not how the coral is.
Skilled hobbyists have worked to get them like that. And we don't mean to discount that effort at all, because those people are really, I mean, taking aside the whole industry of like just increasing the price by having a known name on it.
Right.
There's a lot of good work that goes into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the problem. the guy who originally went out on the reef and saw some acro and said, pop a little piece off of that. Probably didn't pop a little piece. He probably popped a pretty big colony off of it, right? And brought it back and put it on a distributor's desk and said, pay me for that. And then it got shipped off to some guy out in California, Miami, Seattle, New York, wherever. The guy who picked that up probably got paid a nickel or 50 cents for that coral.
That's true. Once.
Once. The guy who sold the yellow Phoenix Angel Acro is going to get paid $150 for a whole mess of frags out there.
Mm-hmm.
How is that guy in... We're gonna go back to Fiji because we're gonna talk about Fiji a little bit longer. How is that guy in Fiji gonna make more money on that coral that he collected? Where's that money coming from?
Yeah, and what is his incentive to maintain colonies of that there that he can pull those frags off of? Yeah.
He's not gonna go out. By the way, when Fiji closed down, he's not making any money off of that. But the guy who pretended that was us. Right.
Yeah. Let's so say because let's take yeah, some let's responsibility because we are aquarists We're, here.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
So we found the yellow Phoenix Angel Acro,
and we thought it was still super cool.
A pile of money mm-hmm. off of that yellow Phoenix Angel Acro.
Now I want guy, one.
I know, right? We should find that one. So what Fiji was doing that actually kind of mitigated that a little bit was Phoenix set up Phoenix. Fiji set up these amazing in situ mariculture centers where they would go and collect just a small part of an acro they would find on the reef. They wouldn't take the colony. They'd trim it. And then they'd farm it. They'd grow it on racks.
It's so cool.
Yeah. The aquaculture stuff that they did was incredible.
See, we're making the distinction mariculture, right?
Mariculture.
Yes.
Yes. The mariculture that they did was incredible. And what that did is that kept the money flowing into those coral farmers' hands.
Yeah.
Kept them wanting to protect those reefs. Kept that's where their income came from.
It's giving them an incentive to keep that habitat working.
Right.
Yeah. Remember those amazing leathers we used to get out of Fiji?
Ah, the Fiji leathers were great.
They were, like, incomparable how beautiful they were, those maricultured corals. Because they were huge when they came in. As somebody who loves invertebrates and thinks corals are awesome and does not care about what they're called, those corals to me were better than the aquacultured corals we could get.
Definitely. The interesting thing about some of the SPS corals that we were getting in mariculture, if we would try to break one, they were harder to break.
Yeah.
Same size coral, same size skeleton. What it was growing in the wild that made that coral harder, stronger, I don't know.
Who knows? But the amount of time and effort and money we take to get our water close to seawater
right.
is like so much, and to recreate that consistently in this tiny water volume of, let's say, 200 gallons, because the ocean is giant and it creates that environment naturally that those corals thrive in. We can't pretend that we can do as well as it can.
Right. what do we do there? I don't mean to take away from the feeling of, hey, if I grow this coral and I frag it out, I'm not pulling something off the reef.
Yeah.
But we're taking something away.
Well, with coral, it's harder, I think. Like with fish, I don't know. It seems simpler to me. Just because coral grow.
Let's run with that for a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know what, I don't have an easy way to articulate that, but like, maybe it's because I'm sort of, my roots as an aquarium hobbyist are in plants. So the idea of growing them out and just like giving them to someone seems natural to me. Because with plants, that's pretty normal. Right. Like, you just have a ton of plans. You give them to whoever wants them.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think if I were to look at corals initially, I would want to support those. And it's a choice that you have to make if you want to support those people who are harvesting those in those areas, those impoverished people who were trying to incentivize to maintain our reefs, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We want those to exist. We should pay people to keep them healthy.
I have an example of where that's not happening. And it's just a perfect storm of... there's just not the right fish there. There's not the demand for them, even if there was. And if there was the demand, I'm not even sure it would be sustainable. But in the Indo-Pacific region, there are these peat swamps. And these peat swamps are native to things like licorice gouramis, betta coccinea, hexazona barbs, chili rasboras. Just trying to think. I'm trying to hit the board.
Yeah.
So these very same habitats are, so if you were in a peat swamp and you looked up, you would, there's a pretty good chance you'd see an orangutan.
Yeah. If you're really, really lucky.
Yeah. So when I tell a lot of people, when you want to know how to conserve these organisms, research efforts to protect orangutan habitat. So the biggest threat to orangutan habitat right now is palm oil plantations. Because palm oil right now is in this really weird, at least from my perspective on how the economics work, it's in this weird, super high demand, so it needs to be sold in bulk. And the decisions that the people in these regions are making are, do I make the farm bigger or do I let my kids go hungry? And so...
You can't blame the farmer.
No, like that, if I was in that situation, that is an easy decision to make. But since they don't have alternative sources of income, that's all they got.
Yeah.
And that's all the market gives them. Because for some reason, we've all decided we want palm oil in literally everything.
And... we didn't even need to decide. It was decided for us, and we just accepted it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's depressing, and it
is
sucks.
Depressing.
And it just...
I had a conversation today, because I do volunteer with some native species here, and I was having a conversation with some of the people that I work with, and I told them, like, we were talking about conservation, and we were talking about the things that people see and the things that I don't. And I said, as just like a blanket statement, I said, every month a 2-inch fish goes extinct and nobody notices.
Yeah.
And I believe that. Yeah. I don't have data to back that up, but I don't think that that's an excessive claim.
Right.
Every single species of licorice gourami is considered highly endangered because they come from a very specific specialized habitat. And a lot of it has been taken away to make palm oil, and it is not unreasonable to expect that in the next decade or two, it'll be gone.
So maybe this is a really good opportunity to turn the discussion around and talk about what good captive breeding does. Because we've talked a lot about how getting wild-caught fish is beneficial, but in situations like licorice gouramis where they are threatened by forces that we cannot control, other than eliminating palm oil from your diet as much as you can, does captive breeding keep those fish in existence?
We know from the red-tailed shark and the white cloud mountain minnow, that yes, it keeps them in existence.
Yeah. In the same conversation I had today, I told them that there are 2-inch fish that you can buy at our local grocery stores that are extinct in the wild.
Right.
And that's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah. Well, if it's extinct, then it's rare, but it's not. They're everywhere. White clouds, you can buy them everywhere.
You could buy them as feeder fish.
Yeah, you can. And they're extinct, theoretically.
Right. In the wild.
In the wild, right?
In the wild,
that's all that counts.
Term.
Yeah.
That's the term.
So the aquarium hobby can, in supporting captive breeding in certain fish, can keep those species alive.
So here's a... I'm throwing another twist in, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of what this conversation seems to be all about. I had some buddies about 15 years ago that used to like to go on collecting trips.
Mm-hmm.
their favorite place to go collecting was Florida.
Jeez.
The best places to go, they knew where a lot of the... All right, so I'm going to back up a little bit here, okay? So one of the statistics that's thrown out about how bad the aquarium industry is, the evil aquarium industry, man, where 80%...
My God.
80% of freshwater fish are farm-raised.
Mm-hmm.
80% of saltwater fish are wild caught. Well, the crazy cluster bleep, of Florida, when it comes to invasive species, their favorite place to go collecting was Florida. And they knew where the fish farms were, and in the ditches around the fish farms, which, oh, by the way, feed into the river systems, that was the best place to go collecting.
Yeah.
And blue gouramis and plecostomuses and apple snails and platies and all kind of stuff that's not supposed to be in Florida.
I'm all sorts of triggered right now.
Mm-hmm. I think...
Well...
I'm just going on a riff here.
Go.
Like, yeah. So this isn't a fully formed thought, but I sometimes feel like that aquarium breeding is just like one of those industries that just shouldn't be upscaled.
Yeah.
Like, I think all the best breeders are like hobbyist breeders or people who are like small scale. Like, all I do is epistogrammas and I have like 8 species, but
and
that's
they're perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, well, I mean, it's hard. We're in Grand Rapids, right? It's like breweries. What, do you want the big national brewery that's pouring out water that's sort of flavored like beer?
Urine flavored.
Yeah, exactly. But or do you want the craft brew that is delicious that I'm drinking right now? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of why we as a business get as many fish as possible from local breeders, because they care.
Yeah.
Farm-raised fish, I mean, you throw them in a pond and you pull out whatever comes out.
Right.
Most of the time, the quality is poor. Wild-caught fish, because of natural selection, it does a lot of the work for us, where we end up with healthier fish a lot of the time.
Often.
Yeah.
Cardinal tetras are the perfect example.
Oh, right? The wild-caughts are so much better than the captain-raised.
Actually, Romeo's and cardinal tetras, yeah. The wild-caughts are way better.
Yeah, they come in bigger, they're hardier. As long as we take a couple of precautions with them. But, like, if you're going to get things captive raised, getting from a hobbyist is almost always better, because they look at their fish and they notice which ones aren't doing well and they breed the ones that are healthy.
Yeah.
Or, and it's not even just that. It's like, I know people in the club that if I bought something from them, they would have an exciting story of like, so I tried this pair and it didn't work and blah, blah, blah. And this male is a jerk, but this male is just great. Like, they know their fish. It's a deeply personal experience for these people.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they like being a part of the process.
Craft aquarium fish. I'm telling you, the metaphor works.
I mean,
I'm not hating that term, Amy.
No, you're not wrong. I am. I'm all the chips in the middle of the table on that one. That one's really good.
Yeah.
And the fish that come from farms are the ones that we treat by default. The ones that they are bred en masse. They're Flatties. Pretty much always diseased. They're pretty much all. I mean, farm raised cardinal tetras.
True.
They always come in with diseases.
True.
So. It's an argument for wild caught, but the argument I think that we're mainly trying to make is responsible sourcing. I mean, inform yourself.
That's it.
Just to really throw a wrench in things, I got an example of where I think unless you're trying to breed it in a specific way, you should probably always be getting it captive bred.
All right, let's hear it.
Clownfish. The wild caught ones don't ship well. When you pull them off an anemone, if you take the entire colony, the anemone is probably going to get eaten.
Yeah.
And they are stupidly prone to shipping stress. Brooke Linella and Marine Ick are almost ever-present problems with the wild-caught ones.
I don't think I've ever seen a wild-caught clownfish that I know of.
It's been a while since I've seen someone.
But it's lifestyle-dependent. I mean, clownfish lifestyle is not replaceable. They have a symbiotic relationship with an anemone. The same way that we don't carry cleaner wrasses, it's less of an important thing for us to say we don't carry wild-caught clownfish, because really at this point that's not really as much of a thing. But like, they do defend that anemone, and if they didn't, that anemone would probably be gone, and if we took that anemone, that clownfish would probably be gone.
And that's the distinction I think we need to make here, but I thought it was a useful point, because captive bred clowns are, like, I think the marine hobby kind of exists in the way it does because of clownfish, for better or for worse, but they've always been there for us. And we should kind of do the same for them.
That's the right way to put it.
Yeah. The amount of people that get into aquariums because of clownfish. And this happened before that famous movie.
Well, there was a reason they chose it for that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did they choose a blue tang?
It's arguably one of the lamest tangs.
I digress. Well, they're pretty. I didn't hate them as much until the movie came out.
I still think that there are way many cooler tangs, though. Like, blue tangs are, personality-wise, not one of the most, like, outgoing.
Dumb, like the character in the movie.
They're a little dumb. They're not outgoing. They're not.
The analogy you made a couple of weeks ago about how, like, tangs are like cows. Like, my brain immediately went to a hippo tang.
Absolutely.
Which, cows are very sweet, and hippo tangs are very sweet once you have finally won them over and they're willing to come out of their crevice.
Yeah, cows are smarter.
I would argue that, yeah, for sure. Okay, well, we could talk about that all day, too. What do we have left to talk about?
You know, Amy, you nailed it. Resourcing. Sourcing.
Yeah.
Right? It's all about sourcing. So Charles said, see, when you can get captive raised. Well, no. Yes, with clownfish. No, with cardinal tetras.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
So yes, how do you know?
Venison barbs. No, with yellow tangs. I mean,
so
no,
here's, say, okay, but here's my, let's take this in a completely different direction.
Cool.
And I think, so I'm somebody who really values our zoos and aquariums. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who thinks that they are valid, and I think that they are well regulated to, for the most part,
here in the United States.
Yes, here in the United States, to produce us with facilities that are well capable of maintaining our animals' health in a healthily way, in a healthful way. Right. Yeah. So there is an organization that sees over our zoos and aquariums. It's the AZA. And I do not go to an animal care facility unless I know that it's approved by them.
And I know of facilities that have a quote-unquote ZAA accreditation.
Yeah, that's the made-up one.
That's the mail order, like, university decree equivalent of, like, zoo accreditation. Yeah. It means nothing.
It does. They just give it to you because, but the AZA, not the ZAA, because it is a thing. And it's creepy that somebody is doing that.
Yeah.
Right?
So when, like, and I'm not naming names. I'm saying there are places within driving distance that tout their ZAA accreditation.
Several, actually. Yeah. Several.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My point there is that regulation, like, if you are somebody who wants to be mindful of how you interact with our animals on our planet, then you think about who is overseeing that. And I know what the requirements are for the AZA, and they are not light.
No.
They tried that in the aquarium hobby.
Yeah.
Right. It was called MAC certified, Marine Aquarium Council. It failed.
Yeah. Well, and beyond that, I mean, that would have been such a specialized thing, like, just for marine aquariums. But there's nothing like that for even pet stores.
No.
There's nothing like that to say, hey, these guys are trying, even.
Right. So what that means is it is our responsibility. We've talked about it before. We talked about it when we did our discussion about fish that don't belong in the hobby. It is our responsibility as aquarists, from the hobbyist level to the grocery store aquarium manager level, to the big box store manager level, to a hobbyist store like us level, to the wholesalers, to the distributors, to the collectors. All of those, it is our responsibility to figure out how to do this right. Because no one else will. And if we don't, we're going to either A, destroy stuff and kill a lot of stuff, or B, have it taken away.
Yeah, and alternatively, if we don't want to look at it from that dark of a perspective, our potential here is to fund those habitats.
Thank you.
There's so much potential. I mean, if I could throw money at people catching fish for me in the Amazon, if I could throw money at the guys who got us Pavlicochromis rolophicolente, you know?
Right. We kind of do, by the way.
We kind of do, because those are wild caught, and we are, you know?
Right.
But, like, we have that opportunity to support those ecosystems instead of destroying them, so let's try and take it the best we can.
Yeah. It's a discussion that Ben and I have had similar iterations of, not always pertaining to this topic, but when you have infinite freedom, that means you have infinite responsibility.
Yeah.
And the aquarium hobby has a lot of freedom in it, and that means we cannot take that lightly.
Right. Because there's nobody standing over us telling us we can't.
So there we have it. Hopefully somebody got mad about this one. Hopefully somebody got happy about this one. Hopefully somebody smiled, and hopefully somebody decided to take some action.
Someone comes in and just punches me in the face and leaves.
And by the way, those of you home aquarists who are doing captive breeding, you are the ones we root for.
Keep doing it.
Keep doing it. Like, for God's sake.
Right. We need you now more than ever.
The American Live Bearer Association, the American Killifish Association, anyone who is breeding bettas at the Paris for Menace Project, and those people are the ones we root for because they're saving those species.
Just so we're not leaving anybody out, American Cichlid Association, the NANFA, the Native Fish, North American Native Fish Association, all of those organizations.
Yeah, I only know about swamp fish, so. Yes, but like all the people, the private breeders, you're not the ones we're calling out.
So are we calling out the big saltwater fish breeders?
They're big is quote unquote, I think.
There's a difference between being well known and being big. You know, and I'm
all right. So today we were looking at lists from our, and we like them and we buy fish from them. We were looking at our two main saltwater tank raised saltwater fish wholesalers. One of them, most of their fish come from Bali, come from a home country. The other one, most of their fish are bred down in Florida.
Well, the fish that I'm excited about from them come from Hawaii, where we can't collect, the Red Sea, where it's difficult to collect, and fish that are hard to maintain in aquariums, like the dragonettes. So, like, we've got good reasons. And the stuff that they're breeding is for good reasons, generally speaking, I would say.
You were so exactly quick right on the ball on that one. I was sitting here like,
Amy, if you wish, now you have the opportunity to drop the microphone.
But
yeah, that's
like,
it.
I'm so in support of the companies that are doing marine breeding because they're choosing their fish so wisely.
And they're being so innovative right now.
Oh,
and
yeah,
we need to reward that.
Yeah.
Because this is another example of where the marine hobby is just a couple decades behind the freshwater hobby. And there really isn't, like, there are some people trying to, like, the Marine Breeding Initiative, but it has not picked up anywhere near the steam that, like, freshwater fish breeding. And I understand why.
It's so much harder and costs so much more money.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's scary.
Yeah. This week, actually, today we learned, we were reminded of sometimes just how easy it is to breed freshwater fish. We had a tank that had only gold barbs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, I'll take all of them. And they bought all the gold barbs, and we didn't right away put other fish in that tank. And today we went downstairs and Charles said, hey, check it out. We got baby gold barbs. If there was a marine fish that worked with, man, that'd be sweet.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have a feeling that as a hobby, someday we'll get to the point where we know how that is done. We have equipment to do that. And because a lot of our challenges in marine breeding come from the equipment that we use that kill tiny fish.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe we'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no easy answer.
Yeah. Did we solve anything today?
No, nope. We just pissed people off.
We pissed ourselves off at least.
A little bit. So we're going to go back to those terms we used. Corals. Some of the corals that people are producing locally, not producing, they didn't produce anything, selecting.
Yeah.
Locally. They come up with some amazing corals. That doesn't mean we shouldn't figure out how to make sure money from our industry, from our hobby, goes back into that source country. I don't know the right solution to that. And some of those source countries are making it really hard for us to do that.
Yeah.
But with coral, somehow we need to find a way to keep supporting those people that depend on the ocean. Support sustainable practices.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some of those things that... Because I think we didn't say it. What do people turn to beyond just food fishing? I mean... They can mine the reefs. There's so many other ways to make money off of the reefs that involve destroying them.
Right.
Yeah. So
there's ecotourism, sustainable collection. I'm not going to say collection. I'm going to say sustainable fishing, because there's lots of sustainable food fishing happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of unsustainable food fishing happening in the world as well. But ecotourism and sustainable fishing... Sustainable ecotourism, because there's unsustainable ecotourism too.
God, yeah.
Pretend I didn't bring up ecotourism.
It's so complicated, and maybe we need to leave our listeners with a message if this whole conversation has just been incredibly discouraging for you, because it's really hard to stay informed. What do we think that hobbyists can do? And my answer is ask as many questions as possible.
That's the right way to say it.
Like that customer who came in and I mentioned earlier in this episode, who came in and was debating wild caught versus captive bred marine fish with me.
I love that.
She was my favorite customer I've had. And like, it was not a gentle discussion, but it was interesting and fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason that I have this torch to carry of Denison barbs is because we had some, and we had somebody come in, and I took him down to the basement tour, and I was showing him all the cool stuff we had, and he said, "Why do you have Denison barbs?" And I was really taken aback, and I said, "I don't know. Let me find out." And that was like, that's the reason that I keep bringing that up, is because somebody called me out and I was like, thank you. Like, thank you for doing that, because I want to know. I always need to know.
Anybody that doesn't want to know has the wrong agenda.
Yeah.
Every day I walk into the store, I learn something I did not know when I had not walked in, I guess. I don't know how I'm going to phrase that. But like...
Yeah.
And I think that's true for each of us here, and we have several years of experience. And I think that's one thing that we need to make sure that people that like are intimidated by a conversation like this, like that feeling doesn't really go away with experience. You just kind of learn to live with it, I guess.
You get better at it. It's part of the hobby. You need to practice.
And so I say that being trying to be empathetic. Because we were all there once. We all know what it's like and how that feels. And don't be discouraged. Just stick it out. It's fun and it's worth it.
Yeah, and ask everybody. Like, you know, if somebody tells you one thing, ask somebody else. See if they tell you something else. And that's how you go about it.
That's how the right phrase, asking questions, is the answer. Don't go in judging. Don't go in lashing out. Ask questions. Hey, why are you keeping that one? And today, we do have Dennis and Barb's.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody would walk in and say, hey, why do you have Dennis and Barb's? And we can say, we have Dennis and Barb's because we made sure we have only captive bred Dennis and Barb's.
Yeah, it made me better. It made our store better. It made my hobby better.
I like it. So this was a tough one. We addressed mariculture. We addressed aquaculture. We addressed captive bred. We addressed wild caught. And we learned, hopefully, that there are good reasons for all of them. And there are bad reasons for all of them, too.
Yeah.
There are bad reasons for some wild caught fish. There are bad reasons for aquacultured coral. There are unsustainable reasons for fish farms. There are a reason we need some fish farms.
Yeah. So we solved nothing.
We solved nothing. I thought you were being encouraging the Hawaiian.
It's important.
You need to pick your microphone back up. You dropped it.
All right, I undropped it. I would love to drop the microphone on this conversation, you guys. It's important for all of us to remember right now that everything is a little bit of shades of gray, and we figure it out. We're all trying to.
And if we keep the discussion civil, we can keep the discussion going.
Yeah.
And I know in this conversation it may have sounded a lot like me, Ben, and Amy believe the same way. And that's only because we're moving in broad strokes on this conversation.
And we talk about it a lot.
We do.
We have our distinctions. And that's important.
Yeah. All right, you guys, it's time to step off of our soapboxes for a minute because we were on them all the whole discussion. And
yeah, I would love to hear from someone else because, like I said, we talk about this a lot amongst ourselves because we think it's important that we know it. But I would love to hear what some hobbyists think about it. Where do you source your fish? Do you get captive raised fish? Do you prefer to get wild caught fish, and why?
If you are a fan of those named corals, tell me what you think about what we talked about with named corals and. How we can make that better.
Yeah. How can we make all the hobby better?
But
no, not at all.
They have their place.
Yeah. Yeah. Somehow, asking those right questions and doing these things right are the way we can keep it fun and we can keep those hands wet.